Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 148 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the non-fiction writer and memoirist Marina Benjamin examines the changing role of the personal voice in contemporary memoir, celebrating the sharing of ecstatic highs and vertiginous tumbles, and noting that it's writerly craft that lifts a work beyond mere self-pimping. Following Marina, poet and playwright Alison Hallett takes us to Launceston in Cornwall, home of the writer Charles Causley, in this the centenary year of his birth. First up, here's Marina Benjamin.
It's funny to think of this now, but when I was a young writer embarking on my first book in the mid-90s, just before nonfiction exploded into a period of kind of wild flowering, I used to have these agonising discussions with fellow writers, some of them who are now household names, about how and when, even whether, it was okay to put yourself into your work, to filter events through a sort of avatarish eye that felt and thought and witnessed and reflected, to be present and counted on the page, there alongside the incontrovertible facts. Only when it's genuinely justified was the view that was most often pinged back. It seems laughable now, this show of prudery, when the authorial eye is plastered all over non-fiction, often like some straying drunk wandering tipsily in across the pages, inviting readers into every little intimacy, talking too much and too loudly, falling down, passing out. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, the personal voice is debarred from sharing these days. This wanton self-pimping is something I find tremendously exciting. Done well, it conveys a feeling of unwieldiness and experiment. It dares the reader to follow the writer into dark or difficult places, invites them to walk in often rather uncomfortable shoes. There, at the coalface of raw experience, you can share the writer's ecstatic highs and vertiginous tumbles, their insecurities and doubts, and embark on joint risky ventures into the unknown. Of course, the self-pimping can also be done badly, and for that reason, to better understand how to tell good from bad authorial intrusions, it is telling, I think, to look back at the rise of memoir over the past few decades. If writing the self has had a bad rep, you might argue that it is with good reason. Barely four decades back, memoir was generally acknowledged to be a poor cousin to the novel, as lacking the intellectual rigour, archival creds and historical sweep of biography. It came second to literature with a capital L. Memoir was seen as the province of retirees, jovially looking back over lives lived well and often in the public eye. Politicians, Hollywood actors, diplomats, socialites, bon viveurs wrote memoirs. And what marked them out as narrative productions was that they were genteel, anecdotal, urbane, occasionally witty, and mostly self-congratulatory. They carried a whiff of titillation about them, too. The idea of secrets spilled and gigglingly shared clung to them in a tawdry way, like cheap perfume. In short, memoirs were little more than armchair writing. Or were they? In the mid-90s, writers such as Frank McCourt began the long process of rehabilitating the genre for a new generation. McCourt's groundbreaking book, Angela's Ashes, the story of a hardscrabble family of Irish migrants in America, so poor that one of McCourt's underfed siblings expired in her sleep one night from starvation, shocked readers with what was permissible, by which I mean what its author was willing to put on the page. Mary Carr's The Liars Club soon followed, another book that had a no-holds-barred approach to making the private public, this time detailing a Texan childhood rife with neglect and sexual abuse. The floodgates now open, rafts of writers began to publish books about real-life hardship, both material and psychological, and the process of overcoming it, or not. It was not kiss and tell, so much as tell and be damned. Of course, the memoir also flourished in degraded form, a proliferating undergrowth of so-called misery memoirs sprouting and clumping along the bookshelves like fungi. These poor me tales of victimization and abuse bludgeoned readers with sensationalized suffering, while lacking the more nuanced explorations of inner journeying that writers like Mary Carr excelled in. What's more, it seemed as if you couldn't escape them since they gave rise to seemingly endless sequels. There was Dave Peltz's A Child Called It series, 7 fat volumes that progressed from confession to naked self-help. And British lawyer Constance Briscoe's Ugly, the true story of a loveless childhood, naturally followed by Beyond Ugly. These accounts of crushing disadvantage that the writer had inevitably overcome were generic in the worst possible sense, formulaic parables of empowerment that owed more to the oprahfication of American culture and the rebirth of positive thinking than anything to do with literature. They lacked not only insight and inner life, but invention. They were one-note productions, triumphalist, incurious, and whiny. I watched and read these developments with interest. As a writer wanting and yet also fearing to put my experiences on the page, I picked and fretted at the question of permission. I knew it was mine to gift to myself, but I was also terrified of that gift. I feared failure in the form of license run amok, the worry that I'd blithely expose things about myself or my family without having the discipline or the craft to work those fragile threads of self-exposure into something coherent that could genuinely speak to others. In the end, I gave myself permission only gradually, drip-fed it to myself book by book. I began a book about the space age in which memoir took a slightly self-conscious back seat. Like a polite guest at a party, it said its pleases and thank yous, ate delicately like a bird, and barely spoke above tones that were audible. My next foray into writing the self was a family memoir about my grandmother's life, which in effect was a kind of ghostwriting for a character I couldn't interview. Inspired in equal parts by André Aciman's light-touch family memoir, Out of Egypt, a book that used a child's eye perspective to record his family's expulsion from his homeland, and Jun Chang's Wild Swans, which used the story of 3 generations of women to stand in for the changing face of China. I wanted to attempt a tale in which my grandmother's life might stand in, not just for the experiences of Iraq's Jewish community to which she belonged, but also for a decisive turn in the history of the nation itself, whereby Iraq's early and pioneering experiment in multiculturalism came to an abrupt and violent end. The project presented me with numerous problems, the most significant by far that my grandmother was dead, and what I knew of her life was sketchy to say the least. And so I novelized her. This sounds like a terrible thing to do, to novelize someone, as if it were tantamount to usurping them, erasing their truth, and insinuating a new story in its place. And in truth, in novelizing someone's life, a writer is guilty of such crimes. She is a kind of murderer, because once a life is written down, it has a way of defining family memory, of adjudicating between what is legitimate and what is not, what is worthy or unworthy of record. And when the same stories get told afterwards, it is the printed version that most often gets repeated. The authority of print erases those slippery, fuzzy accounts in which oral history is the vehicle for preserving memory. Looked at another way, though, novelizing someone's life is also a way of rescuing it from oblivion, a way of refusing to let a life story die with its owner. It follows that a well-intentioned, self-scrutinizing appropriator can give someone a voice they never possessed when they were alive. They can right wrongs, counter received wisdoms, and rebalance history's ledgers. This is power indeed. But more importantly, it is a political justification for wading into and overtaking other people's stories. When people ask me about that book now, they ask how I could get inside my grandmother's head, how I knew what feelings assailed her on the eve of her arranged marriage, how she felt when she was unexpectedly widowed, her asthma-suffering husband expiring blue-faced in her arms. I tell them I don't know, not for sure, but I was able to empathize with her in the predicaments that I recreated on the page. I used supposition, talked to surviving relatives about their similar experiences, read up on cultural mores, and absorbed existing histories. My aim was to recreate plausible, true-to-the-evidence scenes. Some people pushed me further. If I wasn't there, they said, then weren't such scenes invented? Yes, I'd say. Did I make up the dialogue? Hell yes. This doesn't make the book a lie. Inhabiting my grandmother was an interpretive act, allowing me to document events that happened to her by reliving them through my eyes. Any historian can only do that much. That is the nature and the limit of their heuristic. Besides, I felt that by over-determining my grandmother's life, that is, by weaving into it experiences that members of her peer group recounted to me, I could make her character better represent the fullness and the breadth of the Iraqi Jewish experience. We've grown used now to the idea of the small canvas standing in for the larger one, to the way that ordinary lives intersect with historical events and illuminate them. Changing scale is a tool of amplification. But what about when there's no intersection between ordinary life and large-scale historical happenings? What happens when you want to paint nothing but the small canvas, to turn your writing energy inward, not outward, to use the radical particularity of your own personal experience to reach out and connect with others? It seems to me that this is something of a contemporary project, engaging a number of autobiographical and semi-autobiographical writers who are exploring new ways of articulating the self. Instead of setting everyday life against big moments in history that we have no control over, they acknowledge that our own histories, our desires, even our minds, can also resemble runaway trains. Writers like Leslie Jameson, Melissa Broder, Chris Krauss, all in the US, and in the UK, Jay Griffiths with her new memoir of manic depression, Tristimania, have embraced this fundamental instability of the self and written about vulnerability, insecurity, self-doubt and self-harm, depression and anxiety, fear and self-loathing. This is dangerous writing because it might so easily fail. It might lose the reader at the first self-descriptive, or should that be self-inscribing, hurdle. It might simply spiral into a kind of solipsistic black hole in which the insides of the writer's head are externalized pell-mell, thrown onto the page without artfulness or reflection, splurged and spilled rather than crafted into a revelation that the reader can easily relate to. When the method of self-exposure works, it does so because the writer is able to call out, even name, a feeling that other people can identify with, though they may not have named it consciously or even judged worthy of articulating. There are so many powerful evocative moments in Norwegian writer Karl Ove Knausgård's autobiographical fiction about his childhood, for example, which, because he has shamelessly raided the minutiae of his remembered experience, tap into a kind of universal essence of childhood. From the crushing misery he experienced when, aged 7, he was mugged by a couple of girls in his class who stole his just-bought sweets and ran off laughing, or his ear-prickling dread of being caught out for some minor misdemeanour by his volatile, overbearing father. When it works, the autobiographical writer can enlarge the realm of what it is permissible or acceptable to feel. He or she can birth new literary experiences. This kind of radical self-exposure is what I was consciously aiming for in writing The Middle Pause, my latest memoir about middle age. The book is a sustained engagement with unwelcome change. I would not let myself look away. The mood of this book is the very opposite of triumphal, for there was little about middle age that I felt I could overcome. Instead, there were depredations and losses and griefs that I wanted to understand and document and also mourn. I'd approach them tentatively, then wince in retreat, before coming back at them again. And I wanted the narrative to capture all those stages. The narrative is not linear. But more importantly, the point is that I've attempted to write about my experience of suddenly finding myself middle-aged in a way that's properly crafted. Plenty of stuff got left out, and what went in was consciously selected. In the book, I am resolutely myself, but I am also a character. I am rigorously truthful about my experience, but at the same time, I played with timelines to make the narrative work. What I was aiming to do with all this was to generate a sense of unease in my readers, to discomfort them, but also to prod them into recognition, just as I had found an electric quality of recognition in the confessional writings of Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, and John Berryman, all of them writers who could be razor-sharp, uncompromising, and brave, their corrosive writings stripped of sentiment as if by acid. The accusation of narcissism and self-indulgence still clings to this kind of writing, wrongly, I believe. But I take heart from the artist Audrey Woolen, whose sad girl theory says that sharing laceratingly melancholy feelings in memoir is not necessarily narcissism, but a form of feminist resistance. In the magazine Dazed, she writes, "Girls' sadness is not passive, self-involved, or shallow. It is a gesture of liberation. It is articulate and informed. It is a way of reclaiming agency over our bodies, identities, and lives." I think she's right. Writing the uncomfortable, unacceptable, difficult, unresolved sides of ourselves is resistance. What it resists are easy narratives, platitudinous answers, and boring questions. It resists cliché and received wisdom and lazy thinking. It resists convention and conservatism and calm. And when it's done well, by which I mean done true, such writing is raw, reflective, sensitive, empathetic, and full of artistry and surprise.
That was Marina Benjamin, recorded by James McConachie. You can find out more about Marina on her website at marina-benjamin.com. Next, here's Alison Hallett on Launceston and Charles Causley.
Charles Causley was born in a small back room in Launceston, near to the River Kenzie, in August 1917. The room was small and damp, and if the river was in spate, it flooded. One day, his mother saw a rat scuttling beneath his cot, and so she gathered up their possessions and moved to a tenement on the nearby St. Thomas Hill. Each week, she took in washing, and if needed, they collected food parcels from the Methodist chapel on a Tuesday afternoon. Causley's father was away at war, and when he returned, was too ill to work. Each week, Causley's mother made sure there was enough money for food as well as for her son to have a piano lesson. Music, she thought, was just as essential as potatoes. In his teens, Causley played in a dance band, and although they found work all over Cornwall, he wryly commented that they should have been fined for their services rather than paid for them. After leaving school at the age of 15, he started work in the office of a local building firm. He was already writing plays, poems, and short stories, but the defining moment of his life came in 1939, when he became a coder for the Royal Navy. Causley hated being at sea. He loathed the war, detested wearing a uniform. In the poem Recruiting Drive, he writes, "You must take off your clothes for the doctor and stand as straight as a pin, his hand of stone on your white breastbone, where all the bullets go in." Causley discovered he loved to travel, though, and later claimed that the education he gained during his years of active service was his equivalent of Oxford and Cambridge and Eton and Harrow. After the war, Causley trained as a teacher, then returned to Launceston and bought a house for himself and his mother on Ridgegrove Hill. Hill is an understatement. Launceston is a town of extremes, of roads and hills so steep they're dizzying. His house is called Cypress Well, after a nearby Saxon spring. And in the poem Sybard's Well, Causley writes of a sound that is underfoot at last of night, at first of day, a sound he recognises as a thin language of water through the clay. Causley painted his house Battleship Grey. To enter, you must take 2 steps down into a tiny hall. It feels as if you're stepping into the earth itself, a quiet so intense it's hard to believe. In the sitting room, you find 2 low-level comfy chairs, various knick-knacks, an old Bakelite telephone on a round wooden table. The kitchen is straight ahead, but if you go left, you'll pass a grandfather clock before you come to another door. Go through this one, and you'll be in Causley's study, the nerve centre of the house. There's only one window, and it looks onto the back garden. His typewriter perches on a writing bureau. His piano snuggles against a wall. Books and records sit impatiently on shelves. This is where Causley wrote, and where he sometimes hid when people came knocking on his door. Like Launceston itself, which was once the capital of Cornwall, the room feels potent, as if it shivers with a sense of power and possibility. In the foreword to one of Causley's collections, Edith Sitwell noted that his poems are among the natural growths of our soil. There's power in his work, as if his words have grown from seeds that were planted a long time ago. In the poem On Launceston Castle, which refers to the Mott and Bailey Castle that peers down on the town from a great height, he writes, "Westward, a cardiograph of granite, Bodmin Moor. Its sharp, uncertain stream knifing the valley floor." Granite is no longer just a strata of stone. It has become the heartbeat of the land. Causley's poems are rooted, placed, specific. In Seasons in North Cornwall, he starts with a spring that sets off her green fuses down by the Tamar, and ends when all Cornwall thunders at my door, and the white ships of winter lie in the sea roads of the moor. If Causley's poems are natural growths of the soil, they are also natural growths of water, of rivers and streams, springs, the sea, and all the memories of war that the sea brings with it. Violence is never far away. It creeps in his atomic use of verbs. The poem, The Sheep on Blackening Fields, places us beneath a winter sun that annihilates the snow. And in a poem written during a residency in Australia, Causley conjures a single kookaburra that machine guns the noon light. Causley wrote stories, plays, ballads, rhyming poems, free verse, poems for adults and poems for children. He listened to the music not only of the word, but also to the music of folklore and local history. His poems related to where he lived in the broadest possible sense. They were political, funny, musical, peopled, landscaped, real and imagined. His life and his work inhabited a world that was at once fixed and local, and at the same time wholly unbounded. This is reflected in the way that his work inhabits a vast array of different viewpoints. He was no stranger to poverty, both in his early life and in the lives of children he taught in the local school. In Timothy Winters, he paints a boy who sleeps in a sack on the kitchen floor and who licks the pattern off the plate when he eats. When someone asked where he got the idea for the poem, Causley responded by saying he didn't need ideas. This boy, and many others like him, already existed. in The Jolly Hunter, Causley mischievously reverses the fate of the hunter and the hunted. Bang went the jolly gun, hunter jolly dead. Jolly hair got clean away. Jolly good, I said. Causley is also adept at infusing the visible world with the invisible. Imminence is everywhere. In Eden Rock, we don't realise until the end of the poem that the narrator is writing from the standpoint of an unborn child who's being invited into the world by his parents. And in I Am the Song, Causley turns the world upside down when he writes, I am the song that sings the bird. I am the leaf that grows the land. I am the tide that moves the moon. I am the stream that halts the sand. Causley's grave is just a few metres from the room where his mother once saw a rat scuttle beneath his cot. He was a man who was stitched into the life of Launceston and the surrounding countryside, who supported fellow poets and who valued being able to leave where he lived as much as being able to live there. As a poet, he drew upon the richness of his Cornish voice and vision, but he refused to see himself as a professional Cornishman. He was a man of the world, a poet rooted in the global as much as the local, a poet who loved to travel. He was faithful to the genius loci of wherever he was, and faithful too to the landscape which has no borders, no boundaries, no flags. The landscape of the imagination.
That was Alison Hallett, recorded by herself. You can find out more about Alison on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 148, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 149, Jonathan Tulloch, in his final seasonal piece of the series, revisits A Child's Christmas in Cumbria, with a stray appearance of Saxon the Family Dog, a big black Bible plucked from a Dylan Thomas sky, and an orange bulging in a rugby sock like an anaconda's meal. Following Jonathan, three RLF writers share with us the best writing advice they ever received. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.